The most exciting thing that I've done in my agricultural career is plant these mixed species crops. There is no end to how cool this is. Like every time we talk about it or discuss it, we find another point that's just so exciting. It just keeps ticking boxes.
Hi, I'm Susie.
And I'm James.
And you're listening to Soils for Life. Each episode, we're bringing you stories about soil, the opportunities in the ground, and the challenges above it. James, Soils for Life has been working with croppers who are growing multi-species crops as a way of building soil health. Why are these farmers moving away from growing monocultures?
Some of the people that we've been working with have been looking for ways to unwind their costs, to unwind their exposure to risk, and to still produce good products, even better products perhaps, but also to have a better livelihood, a less stressful life, a more resilient business, a more resilient landscape.
So why do you think people are persisting with monoculture crops?
It's what they've done in the past. Often they get a lot of free advice that that's a good way to continue. And it seems on the face of it like a system that works. But when you start to see some of the problems that people are constantly racing against, you can see that it's actually a system that's under a bit of duress.
So in this episode, we're going to speak with three farmers who are all taking a different approach to improving diversity in their cropping systems. And we will find out why they are heading down this path.
I'm Rob Hetherington.
And I'm Judy Hetherington.
And this is our home farm called Walmer, 16 kilometres north of Lake King, about 500 kilometres southeast of Perth.
It's broadacre cropping, has been since the turn of the century, and prior to that it was mainly wheat and sheep.
Yeah, when I first took over farming, I could see that things weren't as they should be. There was lost production and dust storms. You know, you'd have a thunderstorm or heavy rainfall and water would run off, and the soil just didn't seem to be right to me, you know, there was something missing.
In the late 80s and early 90s, had some pretty severe health crises. Our first three children had chronic illnesses, so I got to piece it together that it must be environmental causing it. So Rob really started to change what was happening on the farm and go more biological and away from the chemical farming.
You can't produce a good product unless you've actually nurtured the soil. They go hand in hand, you can't separate the two.
Rob and Judy were one of four cropping case studies done by Soils for Life, which included farmers from WA, South Australia, Queensland and New South Wales. And you can watch the videos and read their stories on the Soils for Life website. Agroecologist Sarah Fee did some soil analysis of all the farms involved. Sarah, what stood out for you about Rob and Judy's operation?
Whilst looking towards improving soil health across his farm, he's also exploring the way to rotate his cropping system. What different crops can he utilise? So it's the companion cropping going on as well. So where he's got canola grown, he's growing it with fava beans or canola and lupins. And then, you know, other areas are still monoculture, but he's looking towards how he rolls over the different years, each different part of the farm, getting a different one of those monoculture, companion cropping, or, yeah, the multi-species.
So, Sarah, let's go and look at our cathedral, shall we? Out in the multi-species crop here. Armed with a shovel.
Always got to have a shovel.
Yep. It's looking good. Here we are in my cathedral. Multi-species. Someone called it a muesli crop. But we've just had 16 mil of rain. And so it's wet down to about 5 inches. You can still see the colour here hasn't changed in this clay, but the top 5 inches is pretty well flocculated. But how the soil just all crumbles.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Falls apart. Good smell to it. The seven-way multi-species. So there's 7 kilos of wheat, 7 kilos of barley, and 7 kilos of cereal rye or rye corn. And this is put in with a disc seeder, so this would have had peas, some vetch, lupins, and a bit of canola, totaling all about 80 kilos. We put it in, we didn't know what we were going to do with it, whether we're going to plough it in, hay it off, or anyway, we ended up harvesting it for a cash crop for a dairy. So we thought we'd do the same again, because I believe that if you've got enough plants in the system with a legume, you should be able to just continually keep doing the same thing. These soils here years ago would have been pretty hard. They'd only produce on a really good year, but even then, you know, the grain would get shriveled because of the excess sodium in the soil. So now, because I've balanced the soil with the chemistry and feeding the biology into it, I'm getting the results showing here on this crop here. And so if you know what you're doing with the soil and you address the situation, well, you get a good outcome. And as I said, it's my cathedral. I can just come out here and enjoy it.
Rob and Judy have only recently started to explore multi-species cropping, and it's just one chapter in a long journey of experimentation towards improving their soil health. And it all started because they could see that after clearing the land and years of monoculture cropping, the landscape wasn't functioning like it should.
Martin Williams is a seed sorter operating out of Ningen, and he's been on many farms both as a seed sorter and a coach, and he has a passion for multi-species as a way to restore our landscapes.
Like in the early days when we came out here and ploughed this country up, and you know, this has happened all over the world, you know, native pasture lands out there, and they sailed into it with a big plough, ploughed it down, so knocked out the plant diversity, and planted some wheat into it, and everything went good, you know, fantastic. And then they just kept doing that, and because they've run the system down, they've run down the carbon and the diversity, then all of a sudden it gets harder and harder to grow crops in that situation. So then we're up more herbicides, getting us faster down the slippery slope, right? We've been running diversity down. Desertification, that's what we've been doing on this planet with our modern farming. And if you put a plough into a paddock and turn everything under and turn up all that dirt, our plant diversity diminishes, and then with that our microbial diversity diminishes, because that they all go hand in hand, you know, then all of a sudden, yeah, here we are in the world with a heap of prehistoric soils. And my measure for that is when you run diversity down and you lose carbon out of your system. That's desertification right there. You know, we've got to turn that around. Prior to the biological stuff, my brother and I were in the middle of all of the start of the no-till farming systems, you know, with high chemical use and no-till planters and all that sort of thing. Thing on 1997 in Western Australia. And I think it was the first no-till like thing that was really formally put together. And we were there, you know. I've always been on the quest for knowledge and for new things, like the next thing. I did a RCS course. It was the first one they ever did for farming. They called it Biobusiness Farming School at Kununurra in the year 2000.
And did that have a big impact on the way you thought about farming?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was the game changer. The biggest shift has got to happen between the ears. And, you know, I'm not the first one to say that. It's about how you think. And this is a big part of it, is that there's a paradigm shift from kill, kill, kill agriculture to live, live, live agriculture. The cool part about this is that when we've got those polycrops together, we can't use any chemicals on them. So it's not an option then. We're off that in-crop spray. And while ever we grow a monoculture crop, we're going to have to pandy to it.
So Sarah, I think what Martin is saying is that diversity builds resilience. So explain to us how plants can work together to improve soil health and conserve moisture.
One of the key benefits is that you're actually allowing the plants to support each other. So we're moving away from the perspective of competition and enabling them to complement each other and actually a companion. And that's the importance of selecting species that work well together. There seem to be a lot of magic from four families up because of how those families can work together. There is thought that goes into what species do we select as well. It's just not a case of grabbing a heap of different seeds and flicking it out there. And unfortunately, we're seeing a bit of that happen in some of the seed companies are producing seed mixes and they're not actually thinking necessarily or supporting a farmer to think about what is my resource constraint. They're just, you know, got a farmer walking in going, I hear this multi-species is the thing to do. Have you got a mix? And we need to support farmers in thinking about, well, what am I actually trying to achieve here? Do you have compaction? Therefore, bring in deep tap-rooted crops that are going to help work on that compaction layer. Are you actually lacking organic nitrogen or good nitrogen sources? So that's where you bring in legumes. Micronutrients like zinc and things like that, aren't they limited or that they're more abundant in deeper profiles than things like sunflowers or something like that that can bring nutrients at depth back to the surface. The same species of plant will actually see each other as a competitor because they're looking at the resources from the same perspective. Whilst when there's a different species or a different family, they're actually curious of what is it that you can actually offer me and what can I offer you. That's actually even water acquisition as well. Multi-species crops actually survive dry conditions far more effectively than the monoculture.
Making the transition to multi-species or polyculture cropping can be challenging. Each farm is different and every paddock soils are unique, and it can be a real leap of faith to try something new.
Grant Sims is a sixth generation cropper and grazier from Victoria, and his journey into multi-species cropping evolved as their business grew.
We started growing multi-species forage crops or cover crops that we would then integrate livestock in as part of our cropping rotation to improve soil health and soil structure and function and all those things. So instead of spending all this money ameliorating or whatever, we would plant the cover crop seeds and essentially let the plant roots and cover crops and the livestock fix the soil whilst making money grazing them. So we saw that really positively turning some of our poorer paddocks into some of the, you know, more productive, higher performing paddocks. I remember one year we were growing field peas and it was a wet year, and I went out there was a patch of wild radish that grew in a certain area. And when I looked at that radish, wherever that was growing next to the field peas were 4 foot high and looked healthy as you like. And then when there was no other radish around it, they were only lucky to be a foot high and going very average from wet soil. So I sort of thought, looking at that there, and we started looking at to companion planting. And then we were growing a lot of different seed crops, and we could identify that adding diversity was a positive. And then when we were, at one stage, I actually went and fed some sheep out, and we just had all our seed, you know, seconds at the time, like from our grading, we put it out on the paddock and it all grew, and it just grew amazingly well with pretty well no fertilizer or anything. And we started sort of looking into this, and I started Googling and coming across cover crops, and then we started to sort of work on designing and let's try putting 10 or more species together, and we sowed it out, and we just found, you know, the results were amazing straight off the bat, where we would struggle to grow, say, faba beans or canola on these sodic clays in a monoculture. And then when we put them all together with another 10 things, they were growing up over my chest.
Grant and Naomi have recently started up a multi-species seed business where they use their own experience and consult with world-leading experts to design and put together species blends to help improve the soils and increase animal performance to help farmers become more profitable. Grant says that, like any other crop, planting a multi-species mix requires good management, and that there are so many benefits to soil health and water use efficiency.
There's probably a fair bit of education around just how to implement them and manage them, maximize production and productivity off them while improving the soil. I mean, we're doing this on 8,000 acres and it can be done, but it's challenging to build that system. Last year was a good one, put us to the test, because it was a high disease pressure and some crops were getting 3 to 4 fungicides on their wheat to manage rust, and we did zero. And I've had, you know, some neighbours, conventional farmers going, how'd you go? And I was like, well, you know, we saw a bit of rust come in at one point, and I put our nutrition on it, like with lacto and all this sort of stuff. And I must admit, for 10 days, I was a bit nervous thinking, you know, if this blows out, it mightn't look good. But all of a sudden, our crops just went green and they stayed healthy, and it was really cool.
One of the challenges a lot of farmers talk about is how to get off that chemical merry-go-round. Grant says that getting off chemicals can actually deliver rapid improvements to crop productivity.
If you look at in agriculture, there's sort of three forms of sides: an insecticide, a fungicide, and a herbicide. Now, the fungicides and insecticides are the two most detrimental to soil biology, and they're the two that I reckon are the easiest to get rid of, and we haven't used them for years. Like, you know, we can use them if we need to, but we don't need to if we manage our nutrition and biology. So we've seen a lot less disease pressure, but also it's really exciting. We're seeing a lot of the insects and predators come back in, which are really important at cycling nutrients, but also keeping your pests and things like that in check. Last 2 years, we've ran trials with the GRDC on red-legged earth mite management under our sort of biological system versus the full-on conventional or throwing insecticides on the seed and over the, you know, over the crop. And it was really exciting because I know last year or the year before, you know, at the end of the season, our wheat under our management was full of predators and undetectable pests. But where we'd use the insecticides and the seed treatment, by the end of the season, it was full of pests and no predators. You know, we're seeing now when we go out in our crops harvesting it, at the end of the day when we knock off, our machine is absolutely covered in cobwebs to the point where, you know, the kids don't even want to get out of the cabin because there's literally thousands of spiders crawling all over the machine. And I mean, this is great because these fellas are out there, you know, getting red legs, aphids, like all those pests that we're normally spending money on trying to control. We just no longer have the need for it. You know, it takes time, but we've got that many predators and beneficials within our crops because we're not using the insecticides. We've got the diversity there. It's really exciting when you start to see that life come back in through worms and ants and spiders and things like that. It's sort of that bigger picture thing. If we're narrow-minded and a lot of science is very linear and we're just looking at this problem and let's do this to fix that problem, but what's the flow-on effect? I think as farmers, we're not even empowered or educated on the flow-on effects or the detrimental effects. Like, I think if we knew a bit more of that, we might start looking at alternatives. It's just that different mindset. Instead of going out every day thinking we've got a problem, let's kill it. We'll see, fungicides, the last part of that word, side, is a Latin word for death. So instead of trying to kill things, you know, we just work out ways to make things grow better, and then all those symptoms and things just disappear.
Removing these chemicals has had a really positive impact on Grant's soil and plant health, which flows on to the health of his livestock. And in working with other farmers, he's seen the positive impacts that come with healthy, diverse landscapes.
It's really cool. I'm very lucky we get to talk to lots of different people from market gardeners, beef cattle, sheep, dairy production, cropping blokes. We've had free-range quail people, free-range pigs, like all kinds of things, and honey production and things. Like, they're finding that bees really are healthy and thriving when they've got not just one monoculture like canola, they've got diversity of flowers. So, you know, there's another enterprise. We'll design mixes for inter-row in orchards so we can set plants up to bring pollinators or beneficial insects in to help protect the vines or the fruit crops against certain pests. We can put plants in to trigger more milk production in lactating animals. You know, there's plants that can do all kinds of things within the role of soil. It gets pretty exciting.
Sarah, this is so exciting. How plants can prevent issues and resolve problems, and the way you can kind of mix them up like a nutritionist would. I'm loving reading Fred Pervans's book, Nourishment, about how when animals have access to multi-species, they can balance their own nutrition. So what excites you about this market for multi-species?
It's the opportunity that this can present, and just thinking it through. How can you combine the benefit of those plants together in your field and the improvement that has to your soil health, and then matching up what you're producing and what opportunities in the market you can find. It can be still sold as a monoculture, but then let's, you know, shift our paradigms here. Does it have to be? What can we leave together? I mean, there's even soup blends that come as a mixed bag. Who's to say, could we not potentially explore growing it that way? It's like any innovation in agriculture. Once we sort of get our head around what is possible, it's then how to get ourselves there. It is requiring a whole paradigm shift. But we can't keep running down the health of our system and believing that we're going to continue production. We're realising too much of what we're producing is actually unhealthy as well. We've got to remember these are foods that we're producing. We might logistically move them around the countryside or internationally as a commodity, but whether it's eaten by a human or another, you know, animal, we've got to clean up our game in terms of how healthy that is and how much chemical is on that, because we're actually learning the quite significant negative impacts that is actually happening on health, you know, gut health, overall health of any organism on the planet, really, is being impacted by the choices we're making in our paddock.
And it's often farmers that are the first to feel these impacts. Like when we heard from Rob and Judy at the start of the episode about their family's health issues. But that catalyst has been a real turning point, not only for their personal health, but their soil and their business. Sarah, when you visited them, you saw both their multi-species and companion crops, which have really turned around their farm.
So he's got the benefit not only in the soil, but also in terms of the quality of the product. When he's got the companion cropping, he quite easily is actually grading off the canola away from that legume, whether it's a fava bean or a lupin. So they've been grown together and had the benefits of growing together. So one, providing in-crop nitrogen production to support actual improved quality of the oils for his canola. But he's also got opportunity then for two markets. He can sell that into a commodity market, or there's a cash benefit even if he's producing it for his own use again. It saves him having to actually purchase it in. So he's exploring what options he can create for himself. I guess we're seeing, especially in feed grains, that might actually end up feeding an animal, whether it's a pig, cow, you know, or any feedlot. They're often blending a ration as it is. What are the opportunities there? What are they looking for?
The story about the dairy is because the agronomist that we work with, the biological agronomist, he works with the dairy, and I suppose, well, we share the same interests. I was actually putting a multi-species in anyway and try and change the conditions of the soil because of the scope of the weeds that were in there. And we didn't know what we were going to do with the crop. He approached me and said that the dairy would be interested in trying some. He was trying to get into a new type of thing that he was doing for the dairy. We harvested it, settled on a price, and it was obviously new for us as well. So I didn't know anything about, you know, what to expect and what to look for. But anyway, it's obviously showing in the cows now and the dairy, because they said they had a cell count for mastitis as low as 36, 38, which is extraordinarily low. And their compounds, like their butterfat and that, are really high. So they're pretty happy with it. So he said, don't back off, plant more, and he'll take as much as we can grow.
Martin, we've just heard from Rob about how his multi-species crop is really benefiting his dairy customer. When people are venturing into something new, we often want to see how others have done it first to feel confident in our choices. Have you got any other examples of how multi-species can be a really big opportunity?
Well, Rob's already developed a market with a dairy farmer for his mix as it comes in the header, and the guys, he understands that he needs diversity in his crop. But so that's the thing that we've got to get people to understand, is because we've got diversity in our crops, we've got better grains. One of the classic examples is we had some mixed species crop there and had some monoculture oats to be cut to hay. Anyway, when they come to cut the hay and the oats, we said, oh, we'll do a few laps around this mixed species crop. They did that, so there was no troubles cutting it, drying it, raking it, baling it. It all ended up in the bale, just the same as a monoculture crop. And the yield was the same, so there was no penalty on yield. And then Darren had some rams locked up in a pen so that he knew where they were, so they weren't out and about doing what he didn't want them to do. And because it was only a small paddock, he had to feed them. He put two bales of oat and hay out there and a bale of the mixed species hay out there. and they did not start the oaten hay until they'd completely finished the mixed species.
As a C grader, Martin meets a lot of farmers who are starting to explore multi-species, and they have many questions about how they're going to sort their crops after they've harvested them.
Most farmers' knowledge about seed, cleaning, grading equipment is that when they were kids, there was a Hannaford screen on their old 585 or 711 header that took the chickweed off at harvest time. When you look at these seed grading machines, especially that old one I got, you know, the people just stand there and they look at it for a while, just not believing that they can see this damn thing. It's got belts and pulleys and cogs, and there's stuff going on every which way. That's only a monoculture crop. That's all this machinery going on just for one particular variety. But then when we've got three or four things going in there, it's about understanding the machinery. So when we're grading the mixed species up, it goes through an aspirator. So that's an air machine that just takes that blows or sucks, whatever you want to call it, the light stuff off. Then we run it through a screening machine, and then we screen the lupins, which are the big ones. We take them off the top and let everything else through that. Then we run it through another screening machine, and that lets all the small stuff through it. And then we keep what doesn't go through there. Then we run that through an indent machine, and that picks up the radish and the wheat and the barley and leaves behind the oats. So that's got the oats going out that way. Then we run it through another machine, indent machine, which has got a smaller indent in it, and then that picks up the radish and leaves behind the wheat and the barley. And then we've got them all going every which way.
So if you want to get seed sorted, Martin's got the gear. But what does it cost? Rob, who we heard from earlier, found a buyer for his multi-species crop, but needed his companion crops of canola and lupins separated and sorted. So did it make financial sense for him?
Yeah, I think it's about $25 something a tonne. For canola, you know, if you're selling your 800 a tonne or whatever, I mean, that's a small price. It's more about the actual logistics of the mucking around you've got to go to do it. So, yeah, I mean, sure, it is sort of biting into the profits, but then, you know, if you look at it from the aspect that you grew the canola without nitrogen, you know, and it's an add-on to the beans without having to spray for fungicide. It depends which way you look at it. People look at it in different ways. You know, some people look at the end result money. Some people look at it in the outcome of not having to go out there for the extra application of fungicides, whether it's be one, two, three, four times, the outcome of what happens in the soil, all of these things, there's lots of things to look at. It was the first time we did it, and that's just what we had to do to sell the canola anyway, so it wasn't a real big cost. I still will grow monocrops because we're still feeling our way into it, so we'll still concentrate on, you know, the popular ones, the wheat and the barley and lupins. In saying that, I will admit that where I've had the multi-species 2 years in a row, that when I put my drone up, I can't really see any evidence staring me in the face of the Rosettonia. Whereas when we used to do the mono-species with a legume and then barley and that, always had these Rosettonia patches. So even though I have changed the soil to some extent, I still haven't change it to the full extent that I should be, because obviously the more varieties of species of crop that you got in there, the more biology you get. So the biology is determined by the plants that you grow.
So James, I guess what Rob is saying is that success can be measured in many different ways. What were the goals of the cropping group that you've been working with?
The overarching theme with the farmers that we've been working with in South Australia is that they were looking to either reduce their input costs or get better performance from the products that they were applying. So both farmers were looking to increase their gross margin by reducing the amount that they were spending on high analysis fertilisers.
One of the outcomes in terms of is this financially viable is that reduction in risk. So you've got more options. If something goes wrong, you've got more options. You've got more options in market. You know, it opens up all these opportunities that you don't have with a monoculture.
Exactly. It's a more resilient system when you have more choices.
Martin Williams' experience is that if you're not putting the amount of initial input costs into that crop, then you're not as attached to it paying off the debt to your bank. Whereas if you're putting lower input costs, then you're more willing to pivot and more willing to try something new.
You know, that's the whole thing about these high-priced crops, is you spend a heap of money on the damn things, and the first thing you got to do is get your money back, and then you start making some profit after that. Just for this year's crop that's growing at, you know, at Ningen, you know, guys have got a couple of fallow sprays into it and a cultivation into it. You know, the crop already owes them a lot of money. You know, that's without running off and buying all their fert and then doing all the work and then all their sprays and that, you know. And the spray, some guys, you'd make your hair curl if you understood how much dollars they were spending on their buddy sprays. A lot of people, and especially like these three particular guys that I'm working with, they're sick of sitting on boom sprayers. They know in their heart that it's not the right thing to be spraying this poison all over their fields and the toxicity. And they're sick of breathing the damn stuff up themselves. And that's one of the driving things, is to get off of these chemicals.
Insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, in some systems, they're a huge part of getting crops safely through to harvest. But some farmers these days are turning around and using their boom sprayers to put out biological stimulants rather than biocides. And Grant says it's easier than we think, and there are so many benefits to doing it.
Well, I think in like most probably industries or businesses that you look at, cost of production or cost of operating, you know, is constantly rising, you know, fertilizer, chemicals, all that sort of stuff. You know, we can minimize our input costs or reduce them massively. Like we've set up a shed now on farm here, or a factory, where we produce, you know, 300,000 litres a year of biofermented liquid fertilizers. It's got a lot of biology and all the, you know, we put about, I don't know, 11 or 12 different minerals in as a multi-mineral thing. So that we produce that and inject it in the soil with our seed and then use it as foliage. So it's massively reduced our input costs at sowing, but also by using these things, we can manage disease and nutrition and even insects with these foliars. So then that reduces our requirement for the fungicides and insecticides. And then the other thing is, like, if we can improve our soil structure so we can hold more moisture and nutrients. But another big one, with tight compacted subsoils, a lot of times plants are lacking oxygen. They don't have the root matter and those deep down. And then when we get wet, there's, you know, symptoms appear like, you know, crops go pale green and it looks nitrogen deficient. So we're throwing all this urea on. And I think this year was quite a good year to illustrate. Like we can, you know, high grain prices and things, and then all of a sudden we get the carrot dangled there and we load up on all these crop input to grow it, to push the yield to get to this, because we're all measured on yield. But then all of a sudden we have a flooding event like we did in October and wipes out a whole heap of crop, which you've spent a lot of money trying to grow, and your risk profile is a lot higher. So we're finding if we can sort of have that lot, you know, diversify, you know, with some livestock through there, we can reduce our input costs by manufacturing our own or looking at ways to be more efficient in delivering those nutrients, which is foliar and sprays, a really good cost-effective, efficient way of getting minerals into plants, sort of things like that. And even like with the nitrogens, more efficiently applying it through foliar.
You know, once people get turned on to this, they want to work out how to make the stuff themselves, because they want to use much more than they can generally afford to buy. And once you start to understand the science and where you can practically apply it on your farm, then you can start to manufacture more biologicals than you could need. And that gets you off having to buy conventional fertilizers or having to spend quite a bit of money on alternative fertilizers that have been made by somebody else.
And I think that's really interesting that when you get biologicals, you get a list of how they're going to help your soil. But when you get a bottle of chemicals, it tells you what it's going to kill, but doesn't tell you how it's going to hurt your soil or even your seed. So all three of the farmers mentioned that they want to use untreated seed. So Sarah, can you explain a little bit about why untreated seeds are important?
To give the context of what that treatment is, because we talk about treating our seeds with biological products or stimulants. So The treatment that we're talking here to not have there is the fungicides. So that's a chemical put on there to try and keep fungicide away from actually attacking that seed. So that's actually compromising the immune system of that plant right at ignition, right at first point in life. Because inside that seed is a microbiome that was delivered there through the growing process of its parent plant. So we're trying to encourage that microbiome's ability to flourish either inside the seed or on the seed surface, because it's important to try and conceptualise that any surface that we can look at or can think of, there is microbiome there.
We grow a lot of the seed ourselves, which I think is really good, because then we get that sort of epigenetics, like from we're growing them in our system and the plants are not, you know, some of the new varieties, they're great for yield, but they're sooks if you take away any of the chemicals or the you know, they're nearly breeding them to be dependent on some of these things. So whereas we grow them to be run their own race and look after themselves a bit. So I think that's a real benefit for us. But then, we, you know, it's taken us some time to sort of get, because a lot of the seed companies, we have to put in orders and, you know, right at the start of the year for our whole season, because once they've done our seed, everything's getting treated, and then you've got no choice but to buy treated seed. And I sort of keep telling them, if we need this quorum sensing to happen, which happens through fungal associations on the root network, that is going to be hard to do if we're putting a fungicide, which is fungi death, on the seed. Like, we need these seeds to be communicating through the fungal networks, and how does a fungicide help that? So that's where they've got to go, like off the seed, to be honest. The other really exciting thing that we're just sort of doing now, and being very fortunate to be involved in this pilot program, they're making a fungal inoculant to go on the seed to make the plant sequester more carbon. And we did it last year and the year before. I know I haven't seen the results back from this harvest yet, but last year we, with our canola, we were growing with this fungi on the seed. We sequestered the most amount of carbon in the project, and it worked out to be 7.7 CO2 tons per hectare. And that's where I think it's really exciting going forward. You know, with these multi-species, we can get this stuff out there on the seed. We can, you know, we can look at the plant's ability to photosynthesize, and we can measure that with a Brix meter. We now know ways that we can, because we've done this and we've measured this through these projects, how we can push that plant's ability, or essentially prime that plant to photosynthesize at a higher capacity by stimulating it with nutrition and biology. Therefore, once we get that Brixing higher, those plants become less susceptible to disease, frost, insect attack. They become more nutrient dense, which means more live weight gains, and or selling that produce to humans or people to eat, they're eating a more balanced, nutrient-dense food, which means less health problems for the greater community that people that are eating crops grown this way. Also, the higher we get that nutrient density, the greater that plant's ability it is to fix and pump carbon into the soil. And we've measured this and seen it. So it's really exciting, because this carbon thing is right on the forefront. We're all going to have to do carbon budgets in 2030. And now we can go out there and baseline and measure our soil. And by stimulating the plants and growing them in under this system, we know we can pump more carbon, which then we can be paid for, and it's having a good effect on the environment.
Grant made the change to multi-species by taking small steps. He has had many challenges along the way and says it's all about being flexible.
Everything's challenging. We're constantly facing soil moistures at different levels. We've got wet years, dry years, temperatures, all things. So it's constantly changing. So in this approach, we've got to be very adaptive and be able to read and do all that. But then when you do have some of these things in place, structure and fungi, a lot of the symptoms start disappearing. When we're doing multi-species and potentially more grazing or kind of system, that makes it kind of easier when you have the diversity in there and you're just managing grazing, and if you've got the odd weed or whatever. And we find when we get diversity and we have far less pressures of insects and disease anyway, when we go into cropping and growing monocultures into this system, that's when it gets a little bit trickier, because, you know, it's transitioning or weaning off some of these sides and or potentially some of the high rates of fertilizers without losing yield in the process and profitability. We've got paddocks now that we might have put, you know, 15 kilos of urea on and cut up to 7-8 tons of hay off it, or like of just a straight oat crop, which, you know, traditionally around here you'd put 200 to 300 kilos of urea on it, but when we've got those microbes and soil structure and that working, it makes it easier to do that. So the challenge is sort of getting the soil to that point without going broke or losing yield and profitability in the meantime. So that's a challenge, but that, you know, it can be done and people are doing it. You've got to set aside an area, set yourself a time like 3 to 5 years to implement a system. And then as you start working it out, how you can do that, you can expand on that area across your farm. You know, inoculating the seeds, a good start with the worm juice and things. And then I suppose understanding what's going to be detrimental to progressing along with your soil and try and minimize or eliminate those things, and then learn what things that are positive that are going to help do that. So even, you know, choices of fertilizer and amounts of that, like, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because sometimes too much of some of those salt-based synthetic fertilizers can suppress or inhibit fungi. So it's understanding that, putting carbon sources with it. But yeah, I just encourage people to get out and get to a workshop, get exposed to some groups like Source for Life or Vic No-Till, and there's plenty of people out there doing these things now. It's good.
As we grow the community of peer-to-peer learning from each farmer, from each other, there's certain gems that one farmer will know that another doesn't. And in that interaction of just a seed sale, you watch them share anecdotes and together they're learning. You know, it's not just the transactions happening in the soil, but it's actually the transactions that are happening within the community that are important as well.
This podcast has been produced by the Grow Love Project in collaboration with Soils for Life and is supported through funding from the Australian Government's National Landcare Program. The episode was mixed and edited by Edgar Sgreste, and we'd like to thank all our guests for their time and insights. For more information, check out the links in the show notes, especially the cropping case studies. Thank you so much for listening.